this question is very much motivated by the same way that Lucian motivated the conference is when we try and go towards a quantum theory of gravity, the idea is there is we want to remove as much background structure from our quantum theory as possible, and that includes the background structure of time that we usually that usually appears there. So to begin, I just want to start with what we're going to have to quantize, and this is this absolute notion of time of Newton. So as we all know, for Newton, the dynamics is always defined with respect to some absolute space and absolute time, and particles move around with respect to this notion of space and time. And for him, he began the Principia by saying relative apparent and common time is some sensible and external measure of duration by the means of motion, which is commonly used instead of true time. So for him, it doesn't really matter how we go about actually measuring time. There's this true mathematical time that's just there in the background, and the details of measuring it isn't really important. And I would argue that this notion of this background time has really been inherited in quantum theory. So the most famous argument in this regard is from Pauli, basically says, well, if we want to construct some time operator, right, well, then it ought to be canonically conjugate to the Hamiltonian, right? And if we want the time operator to take all the real values from minus infinity to infinity, then, and we want this commutation relation satisfied, then this Hamiltonian can't be bounded from below. So it's just unphysical to introduce a time operator. And therefore, we're forced to conclude that the introduction of a time, t, must necessarily be considered as an ordinary number in quantum mechanics. So we can't introduce a time operator. This is also true in quantum field theory when we implement the canonical quantization prescription, right? We impose the commutation relations at equal times, right? So even there in our quantization procedure, we're relying on some background notion of time. The situation in general relativity is very different, right? There, the dynamical content of the theory is basically Einstein's field equations that we solve for the space-time metric. And once we have the metric, we can relate how different clocks tick with respect to one another, if they're moving or in a different gravitational fields. And so for Einstein, this is very different than what Newton said. He says, time is considered measurable by a clock of negligible spatial extent. The time of the event taking place at a point is then defined as the time shown on the clock simultaneous with the event. So this is, just to compare with what Newton said, this is an exact contrast, right? There's no background time. We're going to be very operational and just say, time is what's shown on a clock. And Bridgman, he recognizes the importance of this conceptual step of Einstein. He says, Einstein, in seizing on the act of the observer as the essence of the situation, is actually adopting a new point of view as to what the concepts of physics should be, namely the operational view. Right? He says, in general, we mean by any concept nothing more than a set of operations. The concept is synonymous with the corresponding set of operations. So here, he's really pointing out that Einstein's taking this operational view of time. It's what's measured by clock. And this is going to be the theme that I'm going to use throughout the talk to describe what happens now in a more general quantum gravity setting. So if we want to quantize gravity, and we want to do so in the canonical approach, the first thing we needed to do is choose some phase space, right? And so we might parameterize our phase space of general relativity in terms of the three metric and its conjugate momentum. And this phase space is known as superspace. And it's a phase space where each point in the phase space corresponds to a 3 geometry. And then we would cast general relativity on this phase space. And when you do that, you find out that the theory is totally constrained. So you get a Hamiltonian constraint that looks something like this, plus three momentum constraints. And the fact that you get these constraints is ultimately a consequence of the symmetries, of the gauge symmetries of general relativity, namely diffeomorphism invariance. And the Hamiltonian constraint, in particular, from temporal diffeomorphism. So the question now is, how do we go about quantizing this theory? So when we have a theory with constraints, Dirac gave us a prescription to do so. Basically, what we do is we promote our constraints to operators, and we demand that the physical states of our theory, that I'm going to call psi double ket, and I'll explain that notation in a second, that these physical states of the theory are constrained to vanish. So they're eigenstates with an eigenvalue 0 of these constraint operators. And then the next ingredient, what we do is we impose some dynamics, right? We postulate the Schrodinger equation so that the physical states should change in time, should be equal to the Hamiltonian of the theory times the physical states. But because they're constrained to vanish, these physical states are actually frozen. They don't evolve with respect to any background time. So maybe this is a little surprising at first, but if you think of really what the constraints are telling you, is that there is no background time. So it would kind of be weird that if all of a sudden in your quantum theory, your physical state started evolving with respect to some background time. So the question now really is, from this frozen, this physical state that satisfies the constraints, how do you recover a notion of dynamics? Right? And the answer I'll present is going to be, and I mean, this is an old problem, but the idea is to really recover some kind of internal relational dynamics between different subsystems that are described by this physical state. So just to outline the talk, what I want to do today is begin by just describing what a clock is in quantum theory, and I'm going to use a notion of a covariant POVM, so I'll explain that a little bit. And then I'm going to explain what we call the trinity of relational quantum dynamics. So in answering that question of how you recover relational dynamics from a physical state, there have been a number of proposals, and we consider three. And we actually show that they're equivalent. So for certain models, and this is the evolving constants of motion of Rovelli and others, and the Page and Wouters formalism, and then a symmetry reduction procedure that I'll also explain briefly. And then using these maps between these different relational theories, we'll actually show how to implement a change of temporal reference frames or change of quantum clocks. Using these maps. And then I'll go on to describe what happens when the clock in the system whose dynamics it's tracking are allowed to interact. And when you consider gravity, actually, you know that you can't really shield the gravitational force. So at some scale, you should expect a gravitational interaction between your clock and your system. And then I'll look at this relational dynamics in the context of relativistic quantum mechanics and use it to show an interesting quantum time dilation effect that arises when you have some particle that carries some internal clock degree of freedom, and it's moving in a superposition of two different momenta. And then I'll conclude with making some remarks on causal structure and how it might emerge from the conditional probabilities that this relational quantum dynamics is built upon. So the first question is, what is a clock, or what is a temporal reference frame? Well, I'm going to define it as this quadruple here. So a clock is some physical system, so we're going to describe it by some Hilbert space. It's going to be associated with some Hamiltonian, and then there'll be some fiducial state, rho c, and then there'll also be a time observable that I'm going to call tc, and it's going to turn out to be a covariant POVM. So you shouldn't think of this as a self-adjoint operator. When I say observable, I mean it in a more general sense given by a POVM. So just in standard quantum theory, what happens? Well, if the state of our clock is initially rho c, then at some later time, tau, the state evolves. Right? And the elapsed time tau gets unitarily encoded in the clock state. And then what we want to do to construct this time observable here is we want to create an observable that satisfies these two properties, right? Is that on average, our time observable should estimate this proper time tau. And this estimate, the variance in this estimate, shouldn't depend on the parameter we're trying to estimate. So, I mean, these are what we expect of a physical clock, right? On average, when I make a measurement, I should get back the right time. And how good my clock is shouldn't depend on what time I'm trying to read. So this is like an unbiased estimator of the proper time. So just to remind you, as a POVM, what is it? Well, it's a map from the possible outcomes that the clock can read, tau, that are in the set G. And it's a map to a set of effect operators. And what I'm going to consider here is that these effect operators are just one-dimensional projectors. And I'm going to call these clock states. And these effect operators, they satisfy these three properties. These basically just ensure that you get a well-defined probability distribution through the Born rule when you take a trace with a state. And I'll just point out that this last one here implies that these POVMs, these effect operators, are normalized to the identity, which means that these clock states now form a basis for the clock Hilbert space. I haven't made any assumption about whether they're orthogonal or not, so this basis could be overcomplete, but these clock states will form a basis for the clock Hilbert space, and we'll use that later. So now, those previous two properties that we wanted of a time observable, namely it's an unbiased estimator, are satisfied if this POVM is covariant. And what do I mean by that? Well, in this case, when these effect operators are just one-dimensional, it means that the clock states transform or are connected to one another by the unitary generated by the clock Hamiltonian. So you shouldn't think of this as some clock state evolving in time, but rather this is a set of clock states that define a time observable, and these clock states are related by this condition. So that's what a clock is, and just to give two examples, one that appears often in the literature is this notion of an ideal clock. There, the clock Hilbert space would just be L2R. The Hamiltonian would just be the momentum operator on the real line. And then the clock states are like the position eigenstates. Right? And in this case, these clock states, as you know, the position eigenstates are orthogonal with respect to one another. And so in some sense, you can perfectly distinguish different instances of time indicated by the clock. And in this case, because the clock states are orthogonal, we can actually construct a self-adjoint canonically conjugate time operator conjugate, which is just the position operator in this case. But you can consider more general clocks, like a spin 1/2 particle. Here, the clock Hilbert space would be C2, and maybe its Hamiltonian is just the Pauli Z operator. And now the clock states you can think of as all of the points along the equator of the Bloch sphere. And this also would define a covariant POVM. So this is what a clock is. And then now, how do these clocks appear in our physics, right? So if we have some system and it's described by some set of generalized coordinates Q and Q prime, what we usually do is to describe the dynamics is we write down some action, right? And we could vary this action, get equations of motion, or we could construct the Hamiltonian and build a quantum theory. But we also know that this action, as written, is reparameterization invariant under time reparameterization. So what that means is I could rewrite this action in terms of some arbitrary parameter tau, right? And then just by the chain rule, write this action in terms of this new Lagrangian, where now this new Lagrangian depends both on the original system, it depends on these coordinates q, but it also describes this clock, right? This is where this t is. And in this case, this clock is like that particle on a line. This t coordinate runs from minus infinity to infinity, and so this Lagrangian is now describing both a clock and a system. And if you were to carry out the Legendre transform of this Lagrangian, you're going to find that you get a Hamiltonian constraint that looks something like this, where this PC is the momentum conjugate to this t-coordinate, and this HS is just the Hamiltonian that would have been associated with this Lagrangian. So just like how the Hamiltonian constraint arose in general relativity, as a consequence of the time reparameterization invariance of this action, we also get a Hamiltonian constraint. And so the idea here is basically to look at these more simpler systems described by Hamiltonian constraints and try and learn lessons about what might appear in a full quantum theory of gravity described by that more general Hamiltonian constraint I showed earlier. So how do we quantize this? Well, again, we just promote everything to operators, and we demand that the physical states, the psi double ket, are annihilated by this constraint. And this is really the origin for this notation, is that it's to remind us that this state is a state of both the clock and the system. And so the first question you might ask, well, is this the most general total Hamiltonian that one could consider? And the answer is no, right? We could consider a more general clock Hamiltonian. It doesn't necessarily have to be the momentum operator. And also, there could be some interaction that couples the clock and the system, right? And if you look back at the Hamiltonian constraint from general relativity, when we go into a gravitational setting, we're really going to have to start considering clocks that interact with other things. Right, so here, if our clock is made of matter degrees of freedom, right, there's going to be some coupling to the gravitational degrees of freedom here. So most general total Hamiltonian or Hamiltonian constraint that we can consider looks something like this, with some general clock Hamiltonian, the system Hamiltonian, and then some interaction where lambda here now quantifies the strength of that interaction. So I want to first focus on the case where there is no interaction, and return to this question, how do we recover dynamics from a Hamiltonian constraint that looks like this? And so there have been three proposals. I mean, there's been others, but the three we focused on to answer this question. And the first is this dynamics defined by relational Dirac observables. So this was a program that was pushed by Rovelli and developed further by Bianca Diedrich, among others. And the idea there is you have this physical state that lives in a physical Hilbert space, and what you want to do is you want to construct relational observables on that physical Hilbert space that correspond to answering the question, given that my cup is here, when my clock reads the time t. So these are you define observables on that Hilbert space that correspond to answering that question. I'll explain that a little bit more. The other is this Page and Wooters formalism that's started to receive quite a bit of attention in the last few years. And there the idea is, well, you define a conditional state. You take this physical state and you project it onto one and where the clock reads the time tau. And in this way, you can recover a relational dynamics between your clock and your system in this way. And then finally, the third is this symmetry reduction procedure. And there the idea is very similar to reduced phase space quantization. You transform the constraint in such a way that it only acts on these relational degrees of freedom, and in this way you can recover relational dynamics. And so what we showed in this paper here was that in fact these are all different manifestations of the same relational quantum theory. What we were able to show was construct maps from the different descriptions of the dynamics between these. So for the rest of this talk, I'm just really going to focus on these first two here. So if we have a constraint, right, we want to search for these relational Dirac observables. And what a Dirac observable is, well, it should be something that's physical. It should be gauge invariant. So we demand that it has to commute with the constraint, this constraint here, right? This constraint actually generates a gauge symmetry, and we want our physical observables to be gauge invariant. So we're going to demand that these observables our commute with the constraint. And then the idea is we want to find an observable on these physical state that corresponds to answering this question. What is the value of some observable in our system A taking a particular value when our clock reads the time tau? And so what we showed actually was that based on quantizing the series solution for these classical relational Dirac observables given by Bianca, was that actually these relational Dirac observables can be expressed in terms of the G-twirl. So here, what this is, this answering this question, is basically this group average over these clock states, reading the time tau, tensored with this observable A here. So
what do you mean by when?
When? I mean this observable here. So I mean intuitively, I mean when this observable takes a particular value, when the clock reads the time tau.
You mean when? Like this imposing some notion of synchronization, right?
Yes, and I guess that synchronization is encoded in this tensor product here between saying the clock reads the time tau and the observable takes a particular value. Yeah. No, but I mean this is good. This is the point I'll stress, is that I think this should really be thought of as kind of like a logical operation when, but we can talk a bit more about that. But that's a good point. So I think this is actually nice that this appearance of the G-twirl comes in, because it makes connection with a bunch of the other literature on quantum reference frames. There, the idea is you want to take some object that you're going to twirl over, and you want to remove any background information that's in it. So if you wanted to twirl, say, over, say I was interested in the relational information between the cup and the coffee cup, what I would do is I would take that state and then average it over all possible spatial reference frames. So I think that was nice to see that the appearance of the G-twirl coming from this constraint here. So the second dynamics is this Page and Wooters formalism. And there the idea is, OK, we have this physical state that satisfies this constraint. And again, we have our clock states that are associated with this covariant POVM. And we now define a conditional state of the system. And the way we do that is we say that the state of the system at the time tau is the joint state of the clock in the system, our physical state, conditioned on the clock being in the state tau. So you take this physical state and you project it onto one where the clock reads tau. And because it's the physical state satisfies this constraint, and because these are covariant clock states, then you can show that this conditional state satisfies the Schrodinger equation. So in this way, you get a relational dynamics between the clock and the system. So what the Trinity looks like is constructing a set of maps between these different dynamics. So what they are, I mean, their exact form isn't too important, but they're maps between the physical Hilbert space and then these reduced Hilbert spaces of the clock Hilbert space. So this you can think of as a relational Schrodinger picture. And then this dynamics over here is the corresponding Heisenberg picture. So what are these maps good for? Well, one thing we can do is we can implement this changing, we can change clocks that we're using to describe the dynamics. So you might imagine that we have some clock A, and it's describing the dynamics of another clock B and another clock S, right? And that's encoded in this state here of BS with respect to A, and it's evolving in the clock time tau A. What we can do is we can recover this state, we can map it back up to this physical Hilbert space, and then come back down to another clock B, right? And then this results in a description of the system S and clock A with respect to clock B here. And so basically this is a map that acts on the state of BS and transforms it to a state of AS. And it actually takes this very particularly simple form in terms of the constraint. So this is just a delta of the constraint operator sandwiched between the clock states of A and the clock state of B. So now we can examine, very similar to what Flaminia was telling us about yesterday, is what happens now when we change temporal reference frames. So we can suppose that from the perspective of B, from the perspective of A, that maybe our clock B is in some Gaussian state, in that clock state basis that's defining our POVM. Tensored with some state of the system at the time tau A. And if one were to transform to now to the perspective of this clock here, what one finds is you get a product state between the clock peaked at some time t and the state at that time t smeared out over this Gaussian that was the state of B. So I would call this a temporally local evolution. Why? Because it can say that the state of AS from the perspective of B, once we've transformed, now evolves unitarily in this clock B time. There's just one unitary here. And if we assume that this distribution here is really peaked, we find that the reduced state of S is localized in that clock B time. It just is going to evolve according to this, just the unitary generating its evolution. But then now the interesting question is we can ask, okay, well, what happens now if the state of the clock B is now in a superposition in the clock state basis, localized around two different times? And what happens if we'd now transform to the perspective of that clock? Well, actually, we get this entangled state here between clock A and the system. And what this now looks like, the state of AS is actually now evolving in a superposition of two different time evolutions. So, I mean, it's the same unitary, it's generated by the same Hamiltonian, but it's in a superposition of being localized around two different times. And so if you were to trace out, again, the state of clock A here and just get a state of the system with respect to clock B, you now find that the state is mixed, and it's a mixture between the state of the system being localized around two different times. So I think this is really the temporal analog of this frame-dependent superposition and entanglement that Flaminia was discussing yesterday. So here, the statement is, if you were to transform to the perspective of a clock reading a superposition of two different times, then what you see is a superposition of two different evolutions described by here. So, and I'll also just say that Esteban and Flaminia and Chaslov also put out a recent paper that examines similar temporal frame change procedures in the context of gravitationally interacting clocks. So I'm sure we'll hear more about that as well. Okay, so now I want to return back to this question. Is this really the most general Hamiltonian constraint we can consider? And now I want to ask, okay, well, what happens if our clock and our system are allowed to interact? And just to remind you, when we take gravity into account, we're going to have some interaction. So we have a constraint that looks something like this. And then we can play the same game. We can again define our clock states T as these covariant POVM. And we can again define the conditional state of our system just by projecting the physical state onto one where the clock reads the time T. So when you do that, what you get is what we call the modified Schrodinger equation. So the first thing to notice is when there's no interaction, this second term just drops away and you get the usual Schrodinger equation. But when there is an interaction, right, what you get is this appearance of this self-adjoint integral operator, the kernel of which now depends on the exact form of that interaction. Right. The first thing to note is that this is actually time non-local, right? The change in the state of the system at some time t is actually through this integral operator depends on the state in principle in the future and in the past. And I'll just make a remark is you can construct a perturbative solution to this in lambda very analogous to the Dyson series by iterating the solution. So it can be solved. But I just want to give two examples that we gave in the paper. The first was what happens when the clock and the system interact through Newtonian gravity. So if we have some clock Hamiltonian, so if we assume it's an ideal clock, so this clock Hamiltonian is just the momentum operator on L2R, and then it couples to the system Hamiltonian. You can ask what happens to the modified Schrodinger equation. And what you get is, well, the state of the system still evolves according to this Hamiltonian here, right? And it turns out to still be unitary. But the system Hamiltonian now gets these corrections as a result of the interaction, right? The spectrum now gets corrected at order g over c to the fourth divided by the distance between the clock and the system. The other example we looked at was what happens when the interaction looks something like this, where this we now, again, we assume we had an ideal clock, and we constructed this time operator from the clock states. Right? And you ask, OK, well, what if the interaction is some f of this operator tensored with some operator on the system? And what you find is, again, you still get the usual Schrodinger equation, but now the system Hamiltonian develops this time dependence. OK, so that's what happens when you have clocks that are allowed to interact with the system whose dynamics they're tracking. Now I want to go on and talk about how this relational dynamics could be made or could be extended to relativistic quantum mechanics. So in particular, the situation I want to consider is we have some relativistic particle moving through some curved space, and it carries some internal clock degrees of freedom. So to begin with, I want to start with some action principle. And so here's the action for a particle with some internal degrees of freedom. Here's the action for these external degrees of freedom is just proportional to the proper time. And then these internal degrees of freedom are going to evolve. This term here has been constructed so that they evolve with respect to their internal Hamiltonian. And it's going to be used. These internal degrees of freedom are going to be used as a clock. And so I'll call this H clock here. So again, just how I showed to get that previous Hamiltonian constraint, one can reparameterize this action in terms of a set of coordinates in this way. And the punchline is you again get out a Hamiltonian constraint. So this is just the relativistic dispersion relation, so p squared plus m squared. But now the rest energy of the particle now gets this contribution from the internal energy of the And so now we can take this constraint, this is a quadratic equation, and we can factor it into two parts, the c plus and the c minus, and we get where the c plus minus looks something like this. And so if one of these constraints is chosen or satisfied, then this constraint is also satisfied. However, the converse isn't true. But what we're going to do for the rest of this discussion here is just restrict to the c plus constraint, and this amounts to restricting to positive frequency modes. And this system Hamiltonian now, I mean, just when you factorize this, what you get is that it's this square root of the 3 momentum squared plus this energy contribution. OK. So sorry, ignore this last part here. So we want to quantize this. So we demand that our physical states are annihilated by this constraint operator. And then again, now we define this conditional state in the same way. So what we're doing is we're taking this physical state and projecting it onto one where the temporal degree of freedom of the particle corresponds to the time t, right? So this is going to give us a state of the external momentum degrees of freedom and these internal clock degrees of freedom. And what you can show is that this satisfies the relativistic Schrodinger equation with respect to this Hamiltonian down here. OK, so we have this constraint. And we can expand this HS in terms of 1 over mc squared. And we find that the leading order looks something like this, where this is our clock Hamiltonian. This is this external Hamiltonian describing the momentum degrees of freedom. This is just usual non-relativistic kinetic energy, and then some interaction term. With respect to this clock, we're again going to define our clock states to be covariant with respect to this Hamiltonian, so that this clock observable defined by these states now tracks the proper time of the particle. And so again, we're going to define our effect operators. And then this interaction term at order 1 over mc squared is some coupling between the external and internal degrees of freedom. And this is ultimately responsible for the time dilation we're going to see in a second. But I just want to pause to make some connection with other literature. Because we're defining our time observable in terms of these covariant POVMs, we have an uncertainty relation right away between proper time and the variance in the energy of the clock. This is known as the Hellstrom-Holovo lower bound that appears in quantum metrology. And what we can note is that the variance in this internal energy is actually equal to the variance in this mass operator that's been studied by Magdalena and Chaslov in the context of this quantum equivalence principle, and as well to examine gravitational decoherence. So this mass operator plays a role there. And here we see that using this notion of a covariant POVM, we get this nice uncertainty relation between the two right away. And so this was something that Daniel Greenberger brought up as recently as 2017 at the RQI meeting in Vienna, was this desire to have mass and proper time being treated as quantum observables. There, I think he was calling for a proposal in terms of self-adjoint operators. So here, going to this more general notion of an observable as a covariant POVM allows us to state an uncertainty relation. OK, and so the setup that Mehdi and I considered was we supposed that we had two clocks, and we wanted to ask what's the probability of one clock tau A reading the time tau A when another clock reads the time tau B. And so this comes back a bit to your question, Anjay, about what I mean by this when. I mean here that I can compute it from the Born rule, from this physical state, just as a conditional probability in this expression here. So now we get a probability distribution for the proper time read by clock A. And we can ask, what's the average time read by clock A? And it turns out to leading order, it looks something like this, where at leading order, the clock A and clock B, they read the same time. But then at the first order in 1 over mc squared, we get this correction here, where these are now, just to remind you, these are just the non-relativistic kinetic energy of these particles. So the first question we can ask is, well, what happens if both of these particles are just prepared in Gaussian wave packets around a particular momentum? We can compute the average time dilation observed by clock A. And I mean, the details aren't important, but what you find is that this agrees with, on average, the usual special relativistic time dilation observed by these two clocks moving with this average momentum. But then the next question you can ask is, well, what happens if our clock is now prepared in a superposition of two different momenta, right? What happens? So here I'm just considering some state that's superimposed of some wave packet with this average momenta PA bar and then PA bar prime. And again, the expression looks something like this. But now this correction actually breaks up into a classical contribution and a quantum contribution. And the classical contribution looks something like this. So the important point to note here is that this is just a statistical mixture of what each branch of that of this state, the time dilation that each branch of this would observe. And then there's a quantum contribution stemming from interference effects from the fact that this really is a superposition. And it looks something like this. So you can ask, what does this quantum contribution look like? And so here we're plotting it as a function of the difference in the average momenta of those two branches in the superposition for different values of the total momenta of both of those particles. And what you find is, depending on what the total momenta is, there's different optimal values of this of the difference in these wave packets that should be prepared to maximize this effect. So I think now the next interesting question is this quantum time dilation effect, is it observable? And I want to argue optimistically that the answer is yes. So we've already observed time dilation for clocks moving several meters per second. And we've also created, using atomic interferometry techniques, superpositions of atoms moving at speeds that differ by several meters per second. So using the parameters from these experiments, one finds that this K quantum contribution is 10 to the minus 15. So it's pretty small. So then you can ask, well, if I want to see this effect with an atomic clock, how long do I have to create this superposition for? And to turn out to be, to see such a contribution with an atomic clock, one needs to keep the coherence time of this momentum superposition for about 10 seconds. And these coherence times have been observed by Kasevich. So the idea is that hopefully that this time dilation effect is observable with present technology. Okay, so now I just kind of want to step back and think a little bit more about what this formalism is offering, or what's special about it, and why we might want to formulate our quantum theory in terms of these conditional probabilities. So this physical state can really be thought of as this big entangled state between the clock and the system that contains correlations between the clock and the system. So why should we want to formulate our theory in this way? And I think Bill Wooters gives a very nice example, or a very nice reason, sorry, for why we might want to do this. One motivation for considering such a condensation of history is the desire for economy as regards to the number of basic elements of the theory. Quantum correlations are an integral part of quantum theory already, so one is not adding a new element to the theory. And yet an old element, time, is being eliminated, becoming a secondary and even approximate concept. So what he means by this is that really that the dynamics of the theory are just coming from conditional probabilities. As we have this physical state, and we can compute these conditional probabilities that look something like this. The probability of the event B, some observable taking the value little b, when a clock reads the time tau 2, conditioned on some outcome of some other observable taking the value A when the clock read tau 1. And so just from these conditional probabilities and the Born rule in terms of those relational Dirac observables I showed before, is you can actually recover the correct propagator. So I think it's just worth pausing for a second and comparing this with an Evredian interpretation of quantum theory. There, one has this universal wave function that's evolving with respect to some background time. But then the trick is to try and make sense of how probabilities arise in that approach. Here, the picture is almost the exact opposite. You still have a universal wave function or a physical state, but instead you just have the Born rule, and the dynamics are coming just from applications of the Born rule. So now, how might one get a notion of causal structure out of this? Well, when we have conditional probabilities, we can define a probabilistic notion of causation in terms of probability raising. So we can say that the cause, some event one, is likely to manifest the effect event two if the cause happening raises the probability of the effect compared to the cause not happening. So we can define it in terms of this inequality here. So this event two conditional on event one is greater than the probability of event two happening conditioned on event one not happening. So if this is the case, we might say, well, this is likely to cause, event one is likely to cause event two. And the point I want to emphasize is that these conditional probabilities and thus this notion of causality can now be computed directly from this physical state here. We have a way to do that. And the interesting thing is it allows now to sort of connect with different physical models, right? Because this constraint here in the physical state describes the system we're interested in. It could describe a particle, it could describe a field theory. So it's a real nice way, I think, to connect to different systems and how a causal structure in one of those might appear. Just to be a little more concrete, what I have in mind is that we could imagine we have two observables. Say a position observable and some time observable. And we could ask, well, how does the probability of this event happening, namely the clock reading the time, the clock reading the time tau 2 and maybe finding a particle at position x2, and we encode that in this relational observable, and we ask, how does the probability of this event happening depend on whether this event down here happens or not? And in this way, by moving this event around, we might be able to trace out an interesting causal structure. So with that, I just want to quickly summarize what I spoke about, beginning by answering this question, what is a clock? And I argued that we should consider it as a covariant POVM. And then I spoke a bit about this trinity of relational quantum dynamics, which is really an equivalence between three different approaches to defining the same relational quantum theory. And then using the maps that map between these different relational dynamics, I gave a changing of temporal reference frame procedure and illustrated a very analogous, the temporal analog of this superposition entanglement frame dependence that Flaminia spoke about yesterday. And then we considered what happens when our clock and our systems are allowed to interact. And then extended this program into the relativistic regime and showed that there's a quantum time dilation effect that arises when our clock particles are in a superposition of different momenta. And then finally, I sketched a way that some causal structure might emerge, or one might define in terms of probability raising. And I just want to finish what I think are the next sort of interesting questions. For me, I'm really interested in asking what are the experimental consequences of this effect? Can we actually observe it? And then sort of further developing this idea of causal structure from probability raising. And then eventually extend this to, quantum field theory and quantum gravity. I think at least conceptually, how to go to this regime has been outlined. But I think we'll need new technical tools to do that. And maybe hopefully that these covariant POVMs can play a role. With that, I'll end. Thank you.
So we have time for questions. Yes, Ron.
So, yeah, this is, I think, quite interesting. Is there an implicit absolute arrow of time assumed in all of this?
No, in the sense that this physical state there is no arrow of time in the physical Hilbert space. But the question is how maybe an arrow of time might emerge in this program.
Yeah.
And there has been a proposal by Gambini and Poulin and others. Basically, the idea there is that, suppose we can't measure our clock time perfectly, right? So we're going to get some uncertainty there. Then what relational dynamics is going to appear with respect to this sort of fuzzy clock? And in that case, one gets, instead of these unitary dynamics with respect to such a clock, one gets a master equation that describes some decoherence term. And in that way, you might get an arrow of time emerging from relational dynamics. And so I think that might be one way to go about it.
In what way the same argument can hold back in time? It's the same.
Sorry.
Where would the difference between the past and future come in what you just described?
So I think what they do there is in this conditional probability. You're conditioning on something that happened in the past, and so I think when they're computing these conditional probabilities between something happening at time t2 conditioned on something happening at t1, this conditioning process, there's an asymmetry there because of this fuzziness.
We can imagine also using this approach to measure distance,
yeah,
a ruler that measures distance from some set of states. But what's the difference between time and distance?
I think there you're going to have different constraints. You won't have a Hamiltonian constraint. You might have a momentum constraint. And so you could look at that. But I think, again, with distance, you can also define a notion of a covariant POVM. In that case, and I think the structure should go through as well in that case.
I guess I'm looking for where you might see the signature of the metric, distance
coming in
on a different footing in some sense.
Yeah, in this canonical approach there, I guess you're really talking about the spatial geometry, and so you might imagine constructing like, here's my clock, and I want to condition my clock reading the time t and the spatial geometry doing something. And so I imagine that this causal structure, the signature of the metric, would come out from that interplay, asking how conditional probability is between those.
I was just curious about if you're doing this experiment where you're looking for this correction of the time, what exactly would you mean? Measuring?
What's the observable? So this is a good question. So, you might imagine. What's going to be the clock, right? So you could maybe look at, you could prepare some atom in some excited state, right? And then send it through a momentum beam splitter or something, and then try and measure the decay rate of it, and that could act as a clock. So maybe one could look at corrections to decay rates or something like that. Yeah.
So I have a question. Earlier on, when you were talking about the change of temporal reference frame,
yeah,
you were saying if you have a clock that is in a superposition of times,
yes,
then with respect to that, the evolution will look like a superposition of evolutions.
Yes.
Which was something like you have not a unitary, but a sum of unitaries.
Yes.
So is there any issue with normalization? Because a sum of unitaries is not a unitary.
You can write that evolution. I mean, it's generated by the same Hamiltonian in this case. But
how would you interpret the fact that this sum of unitaries will not be a unitary? I mean, the sum of two unitaries can be even zero.
I mean, the evolution I showed here, it was actually unitary, the one I showed.
So is there any extra constraint that you only have sum of unitaries that sum up to unitaries or something like that?
I mean, I can write that evolution that's there as just in terms of one unitary if I want, centered at some time tau. I mean, I can go back to. Here, right? So what I can do is, I mean, this is e to the I, the Hamiltonian tau b minus delta, and then the same thing over here. What I can do is I can break this minus and plus up into a product of two unitaries, right? And then factor out the uas of tau b, right? And then act on it with this superposition of unitaries, which is going to transform this state, which, because of this 2n, this transformed state will be properly normalized. And then that whole state there just is going to evolve according to this UAS of tau b. Right? I mean, I can write it on the board and show you how it comes out.
Yeah, but you see that if you take e to the I delta h plus e to the minus I delta h, that can be anything. Can be even zero.
Right. Well, but I'm not saying, but you see how it still evolves unit. Do you see how this evolution is still unitary?
You mean with respect to tau b?
Yes.
Not with respect to delta.
No, but delta is just a constant defining this superposition of this state.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have one more question about this line thing.
Yes.
Yes. So you use the concept of conditional probability.
Yes.
You have to use projective measurement on this extra system that you compare it with.
Which extra system? I mean.
No, you have two systems that you have relational time as a relational degree of freedom.
Yes.
The clock and the system.
Yes.
So you know that there are no. If your system has a size, there are no instantaneous projective measurements, which we know from Sorkin's papers, for instance. In quantum field theory, always takes time to make a measurement of the system that has size.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you take that into account in any way, or because you have instantaneous measurements of systems that you don't specify your sizes?
Right. So here we did just sort of the simplest thing, which is these projective measures. But one could imagine now smearing out these clock states, constructing the effect operator and smearing it out over some interval that corresponds to some uncertainty or some length of the time taking place. And again, that's going to define a covariant POVM. And in that case, I think.
An extra smear.
Yeah. Sorry?
Extra smears.
Yes, yeah.
One more quick question, if there's any. Okay, so let's spend time again.
Thank you.